Like, this is really bad. And people have not even just been asleep at the wheel. People have been selling us a line. They've been selling us a story so that we don't fight back.
This is a human-made historical problem. Anthropogenic is a fancy scientific word to mean history made this crap. You know, people did this.
Welcome to Eco Alarm, the podcast where we break down the major factors affecting the environment and explore what we can do to help. I'm your new host, Savannah, and I am an environmental studies major here at USC. I am a junior, and I'm also getting a progressive master's degree in environmental studies as well. So I'm really excited to pick up where Imani left off and enter as your new co-host with Beau.
And I'm your host, Beau. Today, we'll be talking to Josh and Amy. Josh and Amy work with History Rebellion, which is focused on integrating climate change and climate justice into professional orgs, teaching, and universities.
Yeah, so Josh and Amy are both history scholars and professors who use their expertise on past events to help act on the reality of the current emergency, which is climate change. They use their knowledge, time, expertise, and skills to help mobilize social, political, economic, and cultural responses to the existential threat of climate change with their historical backgrounds.
We're so excited to talk to Josh and Amy today about what inspired them to join the movement to educate about climate change.
Today, we have two lovely guests. We have Joshua Goldstein and Amy Woodson Bolton. So Dr. Goldstein is a USC professor of history and East Asian languages and cultures. And Amy is a professor of British and Irish history at LMU. Yeah, so if you would both like to introduce yourselves and give a little backstory on how you're interested in sustainability and what you do and your involvement with History Rebellion.
So this is Amy, and I got interested in sustainability probably when I'll just say when I was 8 years old, I wrote to the Secretary of the Interior asking about plans for environmental action. I was unhappy with the policies under the Reagan administration. So that kind of gives you a sense. He, in return, sent me the entire Environmental Protection Agency annual report, which was like 1,100 pages. So that tells you something about the EPA under James Watt.
How kind.
So yeah, right. Really, really amazing. So I've been interested for, my whole life. I will say that never in a million years did I think I would be living through the actual effects of climate change. Or living in a world where we had already, as we were just learning, already seeing 1.2 degrees Celsius warming. Because when I was young, when I was a student, and then later, I thought naively that the adults in the room were going to do something about it. This was an issue, you know, when I was an undergraduate 30 years ago, this was something we were organizing about. Organizing a no car day at Berkeley when I was an undergrad there. And I worked with the California Public Interest Research Group, CalPERG. So this is longstanding. My work professionally, my historical scholarship is on the history of art museums in Britain, which doesn't sound immediately connected, but to my mind has everything to do with the changes and the cultural reactions to industrialization. And people's arguments for art and nature and needing beauty in the cities was all about the disruption to their relationship to the natural world. And my current project is also related to that in the history of anthropology. So Josh and I met about 5 or 6 years ago when we invited the history department at Loyola Marymount University invited him to come and speak on his area of expertise, plastics, as part of our speaker series. And we talked about like, hey, we want to be more active as historians and get involved and join Extinction Rebellion and figure something out. So we connected last year, reconnected and start working together, which has been really fun. So I'll let Josh introduce himself and then we can talk more about History Rebellion.
I've always cared, whatever, environment was always of interest. And but I, you know, I had a very close friend, Annie Levy, who now lives in Wales and has a blog called Kitchen Counterculture, which you should check out if you're really into fermentation and interesting cooking. And she had a partner named George Marshall, who described himself as an eco-terrorist back in the 1990s. And he talked a lot about climate change and also getting arrested for various antics. And I remember at that time thinking, well, I think this is really important, but in a world where there's so much exploitation and racism and we can't even treat human beings okay, I think I need to prioritize how horrible the exploitation and mistreatment of other humans is. And this seems like it's a kind of more general, a little bit further off problem that I can wait on, you know, and think like, you know, humans first and environment next. And then it started to become clear to me the way it, like Amy was talking about it, that like this is really becoming an existential crisis, and I can't believe that no one's been doing a damn thing about it for decades and decades. This seemed like a no-brainer. And I had a kind of, I guess, personal epiphany sort of thing when my sister-in-law, who was incredibly healthy and was an aerial performer and artist and all this stuff, and like the most fit person I'd ever known, pretty much got diagnosed with this really terminal, horrible form of breast cancer. And, you know, so she was perfectly healthy and had this teeny little tiny tumor. And it was basically like, she's going to die. That thing's going to kill her. I started looking around me going like, oh, that's the state the world is in right now. It's a beautiful spring day. The weather is not that abnormal yet. It's like, you know, 12 years ago, whatever. And yet we're on our deathbed. And I got to start doing something. And so I started teaching classes about the history of climate change. And I was already doing a bunch of stuff on recycling by that point. My research in China had shifted over to looking at migrant laborers. And again, the main motivation there actually was these are migrant laborers who are being treated like crap by the government because they're basically illegal immigrants in the cities of China. But that actually had me working in recycling. And so that's kind of the intersectionality of what a lot of these issues are in a nutshell in some ways, that the frontline communities are also the most impoverished and discriminated against in the climate fight. And so it just started to become very clear that these things were all super connected. And I couldn't believe that the academic world was sitting on its butt. And then, you know, Amy had me over for that talk. And at that dinner, we were talking and I was just like, I'm really frustrated. I can't stand this. I feel like I'm schizophrenic. I go into department meetings and I just want to scream, what the hell are we doing sitting here doing what we're doing? This is insane. And she was like, yeah, I kind of feel that way too. And I want to join Extinction Rebellion too. So when she called me up about a year ago after, I guess, Peter Kalmus got arrested in this action, chaining himself to Chase Bank in downtown LA about a year ago around now. And she was like, you know, I just talked to Peter and he was saying it would be, you know, and I told him this idea about History Rebellion. And he was like, yeah, that's great. And I was like, wow, that's cool. I was just with Peter at that action. I was about to chain on myself, but we had to stop that because of some legal issues. So we were already in the same space.
I think, to be fair, most people feel like screaming when they're in faculty meetings. Even if you don't care about History Rebellion, but
that's right. But they can join us anyway. Those people too.
Yes, History Rebellion welcomes all people who want to scream in
their faculty meetings. Yes.
Yeah, I think it was great because then what's basically happened is that I reached out to Peter Kalmus, who's a scientist with the JPL, and you know, studies like that. Temperatures and how we're all going to die. So he has a real like front row seat to the future, you know, worst case scenarios under climate change. But when I reached out to him and I was like, hey, I want to start History Rebellion, he was like, great, we should have rebellions like all over. Like, this is great. We need people to use their expertise to talk about the climate emergency. And so that was very exciting. And then basically joining Scientist Rebellion, it turns out there were all these social scientists already in Scientist Rebellion. So that has been really fun and kind of coming together and finding each other and thinking about, you know, so History Rebellion really is like, we know as historians, and I should say, I also teach modern global environmental history. And, you know, this emergency did not come out of nowhere. So we as historians, I think, have a way of thinking about this where it seemed very obvious to us, like that justice and colonialism and exploitation and wealth inequality and these kind of global issues are all connected. Like that seems kind of pretty obvious to us, but that's not necessarily equally obvious to everyone if you haven't studied the global history, right? So that to us seemed like, wow, that's really something we can bring to the table. That's something we can articulate and think about. And so we are excited to invite other historians to bring their expertise in all different areas and social scientists and humanists to think about, you know, how can we build a movement in academia among people who have research fields that maybe aren't wet bulb temperatures or the effects on an ecosystem, but maybe they are. What is the history of labor? Maybe they are. What got us here? You know, what got us to this point? And so how do we help people see the kinds of inequalities that still exist in our world and that came out of those histories?
Yeah, I think the climate emergency is so often framed as a kind of scientific issue. It's so much framed as like, you know, oh, you have to understand the science of climate change. And obviously, like, there's some basic things there that you really are good to understand. But, you know, I've been co-teaching a class on climate change with a scientist because I thought I'm not really a specialist in this. And if I'm going to teach a class on it, I'm going to bring in a climate scientist. So
I think that was the class that I took. Was that with Vicky?
Yeah, that was with Vicky. I first started doing it with someone named Lisa Collins, who went over to Santa Monica City College. But yeah, and I think that process also got me really teaching with Vicky, especially. She would just keep saying in the class, like, this is a political issue. This is just like this has nothing. It's like, it's such a straightforward. And I just, you know, so it just made me more and more clear that, like, oh, you know, really to understand climate change, like, this is a human-made historical problem. Anthropogenic is a fancy scientific word to mean history made this crap. You know, people did this.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So it's kind of like it became really clear to me that, like, what would maybe be a way to try to frame it and teach it is, you know, talk about, like, why did fossil fuels get used to begin with and what was the point, right? And some of the history of that. I mean, maybe that's not that important to really getting the activists moving or getting other people moving, but I, you know, as a historian, I found it kind of interesting to find that the story behind even the introduction of fossil fuels into mechanical work, which is really the big thing that we do when we launch the fossil fuel industry and create the climate crisis we've got, was to exploit labor better. And that's, yeah, still exactly. That's still what most of it's used for. And so it was really, yeah, I think it's like that bringing that framing, I think, was something that Amy, you know, and Amy also brings a lot of expertise about other stuff, about activism, about the histories of activism. And I like get her started talking about throwing tomato soup at artworks, right? You know, and she can give you a whole great take on that. So I think just like so many ways that historians have a great perspective to bring that hopefully will, you know, get more people doing this, you know, active in this.
Yeah. And it's great to see faculty members who are not part of, you know, environmental studies or like biological sciences, stuff like that, who care about these issues and want to get involved and want to make that part of their work as well. Because like you both have been saying, you know, it's an extremely intersectional issue and it's human made and it's going to be human solved, you know, if or when we get there. So it takes everyone on board to make this kind of thing happen. And everyone cares about different things and climate change affects all of them, you know, every single person. So I really like that perspective.
I was just thinking to go into more detail about history of rebellion. I was wondering, how does environmental action look like in academia? Is it like throwing tomato soup at paintings, as you said, through, you know, writing research papers, combination both? I think it would be a good intro into what you guys do and how does the organization create impact?
That is such a great question. I will just say we have not thrown tomato soup at anything yet. But you never know. We'll leave it open. I'd say we are still in the process of figuring out what academic activism looks like. So we are joining in with a worldwide teach-in for climate and justice that was organized by Bard University. Our members are joining in, some of our members at least are joining in with that. And we have been recruiting faculty colleagues at our different universities. And actually that's here and in Canada as well to participate in that event.
But can I interrupt really quick? Yes, can you just explain quickly what a teach-in is also? Because, you know, some of our listeners might not have ever heard that term before. I know I didn't before speaking with you too. So if you could talk about that also.
Yeah, that's great. So teach-ins, I mean, that is a kind of phrase, I think that I'm not an Americanist, but I think that kind of originated in a lot of 1960s activism and was really around the war in Vietnam and anti-colonial activism. So kind of giving people background on something. So originally teach-ins were really part of the student movement. There were certainly organized teaching events as part of the US civil rights movement as well on nonviolence. I'm not actually sure whether they called those teach-ins or not though. So I would need an expert to tell me that, but teaching, let me just say, has been part of practices of nonviolence, nonviolent civil disobedience, and sort of organized movements in anti-colonial, in civil rights, in anti-war protests of the 1960s in particular. So a teach-in kind of in a that kind of classical 20th century sense was getting activists together, but also seeing how many members of the public you could bring in to explain and to explain, let's say, to student activists, why should you care about this? What is the war in Vietnam? What's the bigger picture of French colonialism in Indochine and Indochina? Why is the United States in Vietnam? What's this bigger picture? So that was kind of the like what a teach-in came from. And then now people talk about a teach-in like in the context of the climate movement to say, I think not only what is the climate crisis, but that, you know, there is a climate crisis, but here is the science, but also here are the solutions that we have. And here is what is holding us back. Because one of the things that has become very clear really just recently is just how much fossil fuel interests have, in fact, played a really long game of disinformation and political manipulation to prevent action. So we've known the science. They knew the science, right? Like they were starting to design their offshore oil rigs to be a meter higher because they knew sea level rise was coming. They've been planning for it. So that's a kind of, you know, the kinds of things that we want to talk about with students and with the public is, you know, there is this much bigger picture of why we haven't done anything, but hey, we could also get together. We live in a democracy. Thank goodness. Let's demand action from our politicians. We don't need to take the idea that has been given to us by the fossil fuel companies that moving away from fossil fuel companies necessarily means suffering and death and economic decline and implosion. We can say there are lots of things we can do. There are lots of ways that, in fact, we could make our lives a lot better by moving into different sorts of infrastructure, different kinds of funding, different kinds of energy regimes, different ways of thinking about urban development, all kinds of solutions that could really make, you know, really make our cities more livable and save our wilderness. And in fact, prevent mass extinction and, you know, death of life on this planet. So those sorts of things are some, you know, those are some of the things we would talk about at the climate teach-in. But I should say also that lots of people who are participating in this are doing something that we call Make Climate a Class as part of the Bard teach-in and what we're participating in, where they're just, you know, so like for some of my classes, I am really going to say, what do you want to know about the climate crisis? Like, what is it that you feel you don't really understand that you would like somebody to explain to you? So we have lots of resources. And if anyone who's listening to this wants to get involved, we would love to hear from you. We'd love to share those resources.
Yeah, we'll definitely share resources for anyone listening on, you know, social media and all of our accounts. So check our Instagram, especially. That's where you can find a lot of information on that. And then I'm assuming you'd be able to contact Amy and Josh as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the idea of teaching is that it's going to sort of break the fourth wall on some level, right? That it's like you're bringing education out of the classroom, or in this case, you're bringing climate change into a class that it wouldn't normally be in, or you're bringing communities together that wouldn't normally necessarily come together around an issue and around some education. So a lot of it is this kind of climate as a class, but we're also having some bigger events where, so at USC, for example, we'll have an event the week after the climate as a class day where folks who participated in that will come, but we'll also have a couple of people who are in, you know, doing either work on solutions to climate problems, where people are going to talk about what kind of actions are happening at USC, with the idea of trying to start to build a more active or activist-y looking community around climate issues on our campus itself. That, you know, like, you know, because obviously you can take a lot of really good classes and learn tons of really important information about climate change at USC, but it's always in this kind of classroom package where it's like you study and then you finish, then you take your exam or you write your paper and you're done. And I think that that's really not, I think the idea is like we probably need to be doing something besides that at this point and trying to build community across all the different groups and then try to really take some action together.
Yeah, and I think at USC, a lot of us are, in a sense, in our ivory tower. Like, we don't see what's going on in the community around us. But Los Angeles, and especially South LA, where our campus is located, we're heavily affected by environmental racism and stuff like that. Especially, we're not very far from the Watts area, a famously terrible environmental disaster and environmental justice issue. So I think there, you know, it needs to be brought up, and, you know, not to be overly critical of the university, but I think they, you know, do some sugarcoating for sure of things. And while they've taken a lot of actions that are great, you know, I think there's definitely, there needs to be more emphasis placed on community involvement and actually kind of getting our hands dirty, whether that includes students, faculty, staff, all of the above, as well as the community and working together with them. Because, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar institution that we're at, and we could be doing more than we're doing.
Totally. Yeah, completely agree. I mean, USC is an enormous influence in this city and an enormous presence in the city, and we could step up a lot more. So can't wait to have you. Hopefully I'll see you at that event next in a couple of weeks, and you can talk and share your ideas. It would be awesome.
Yeah, that'd absolutely be great. So we also wanted to ask, in your personal experience, you know, how many teach-ins you've done and what the outcomes are usually like, if you've personally seen a lot of change or ripple effect from that or any notable effects that they've had.
Well, we do. I will say that the event that we're doing at Loyola Marymount is part of a series that we call History in the Headlines. And I don't know that those are official, you know, those are more kind of regular events, but I also think of them in a way as teach-ins, in the sense that they are a chance for us as historians and often our colleagues who are in other departments around the university to speak to a specific issue in the headlines, right? But with giving historical perspective. And the goal of those, and we've done other teach-ins at the university, but that were like officially called teach-ins. But I would just say that the programming around our History and the Headlines events are really to try to get students or help students making those connections between their classes and what they see happening in the world around them, and to kind of really work on that, always doing that as an just an active skill. That, like, I think part of being an educated person, whether you're a history, I mean, everybody should be a history major, but if you're not a history, even if you're not a history major, everybody kind of starting to exercise that muscle. What am I learning in class, in my classes, that is related to what I'm seeing happening around me, whether it has to do with inequality or racism or environmental issues? the erosion of democracy. You know, what is it? How is what I'm learning related to what's going on? And how can I make those connections and then feel empowered to get involved? I mean, ultimately, what places like LMU and USC should be doing, we hope, is bringing up the next generation of engaged citizens who are able to make a difference, right? And impact the way that we live and reimagine and imagine better futures. But that kind of like that first step is seeing that what you learn in class in college is absolutely and fundamentally connected to what's happening around you, even if it seems distant, right? But then, oh yeah, they're bigger histories. They're longer stories to what we're learning about.
Yeah, absolutely. And also I want to say that history is so important, I think, in general, and people underestimate its importance. And the winners write the textbooks, as they say, or the history books. So, you know, like in Texas, I guarantee there are a lot of things that I learned that are different than people who grew up in California and the perspective that they may have learned them from, or, you know, across the world in different countries. So having a knowledge of that is so important because, you know, it affects the world that we're in right now. You know, it was all built upon what came before. People, I think, dismiss history a lot as, you know, some old guys did something and whatever, it doesn't matter, but absolutely it does.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, especially when talking about like climate change and this, that so much of the material that I end up ever teaching or sharing with students, it's like it actually comes from activists who've done research and have done work, right? It's like all the stuff Amy was just talking about misinformation and the history of misinformation. I mean, it's like, that's activist work. That's like, you know, eventually a couple of academics saw so much of it that they went and wrote like academic books on it. But it really started with like Greenpeace and journalists who were activists who were saying, I want to, you know, like, let's disclose this stuff and let's see like what's going on at the shareholder meetings. And, you know, and over again, that's been true for, you know, the knowledge behind a lot of, you know, environmental racism. I mean, the entire history of it, it has nothing to do with coming out of academia. It's all been communities that have said, shit, there's a problem. Like, this is really bad. And, you know, and some, you know, and eventually it's entered into the academic sphere and then people finally write a history about it. But it's you know, so much of, like you were saying, so much of this, the history of environmental racism and injustice hasn't been written into history yet because it's, you know, something that the powers that have created it are very happy to ignore and not publicize in any possible way. And it really is the people that have been, you know, survived through it, coped with it, faced it down, that are the ones who have brought it to public attention and finally been able to say, like, you know, this has to, you know, we have to rewrite the history about what's happened here. This has been, and in some ways that's what, you know, the climate crisis is, you know, is physics kind of doing that for us, right? I mean, it's like if it hadn't been for, you know, the global expression of some basic physics about what's going on here, we would have, you know, happily gone along ignoring this centuries of this kind of fossil fuel abuse and dumping and just been, oh, it's just a, you know, like a few incidents here and there. And yeah, sometimes there's an oil well that leaks and that's really bad. And, you know, yeah, there's, you know, people fight wars over oil. Isn't that a shame? And, you know, and then like this starts to tie all of that together into one massive narrative of a incredibly powerful system of organized colonialism and environmental abuse and destruction that's sent us on a path that has kind of in some ways finally, you know, well, at least for me, at least kind of finally invalidated the kind of ideals of, you know, whatever ideal of modernity you had that somehow was being sold to us. And that was really what shaped historical work for the past in the West for the past 150, 200 plus years. You know, it's like there's no pot of gold at the end of this rainbow anymore. You know, and we have to rethink the whole trajectory, the whole narrative.
Well, even if there was a pot of gold, most people wouldn't be seeing any of it, you know, it all right. Goes to the top 1%. So
that's true. There was a pot of gold for a very few of the people.
Okay. I think we're towards the end of the episode, but going off of a previous point, Amy brought up seeing the connection between classroom and what's happening in the real world and becoming actively engaged citizens. I know the majority of our listeners are college students. So do you have any advice for young people looking to get involved with climate action, either in academia or elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I was just going to say a minute ago that I think the students and faculty, I was thinking about what Josh said about, you know, it's the activists and especially folks in, you know, the most impacted communities who have led the way on all of this. Most of the students and faculty at Loyola Marymount University and University of Southern California are really privileged. We're so lucky to be in these institutions. We are, you know, in very, you know, really unique and privileged institutions, right? Wonderful. So part of the question is, what do we do to accept the urgency and really look it in the face? Like, here we are. It is an emergency. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as I think I mentioned before, this new report has just come out that said we are already seeing 1.2 degrees Celsius of warming. Already, here we are.
The new report is scary, I'm not going to lie.
It's, you know, terrifying.
We try to keep it positive on this podcast, but
it's terrifying. You
know, there's reality also.
Yeah. And the trajectories that we're seeing are not good. Like, we're currently on the path to 3 degrees, right? By the end of the century. That's bad. That's like, so that's just beyond kind of utterable bad. So, okay, here's the thing. And Bo, I love your question about, okay, so what can we be doing? I think the first thing is you need to demand that universities tell the truth. We need to be honest. We need to be more honest about what we're facing. We need to stop living in this fantasy land that these things, that this isn't real. And part of that is, and this is something Josh and I have talked a lot about, our entire culture depends on forgetting that there is this abyss that is starting to open up in front of us. We live in a world that is shaped by advertising, that is selling us the next thing, that just wants us to be happy, that just wants us to buy something, that just wants us to think that retail therapy is an actual solution to anything. So here's the challenge: is how do you face the urgency, that urgency of now? How do you look at the emergency in the face without despairing, without giving up? How do you listen to that car alarm? And when we were talking before, I talked about, you know, there's this way that if the kind of the popular culture around us, all of the dystopian fiction, all of the apocalyptic films, like all of the literature that we read, all of the TV shows, all of the kind of like, oh, obviously it's going to be like Mad Max. Obviously it's going to be like Terminator. Obviously it's going to be, you can tell how old I am. I am from my examples, but you guys can fill in the rest, right? Like, you can fill in, you know, the Hunger Games or whatever it is. So here's the thing. Has it become just like a car alarm that is going off that you've tuned out? And so the way that the way a car alarm is going off and after a while you can't even hear it. Is that how we're going to treat this emergency? And then we're just going to keep going and keep selling and just buy that next plastic thing and buy that next thing from some, you know, fashion retailer, whatever it is. How do we instead look at the truth in the face, say, wow, this is bad. Like, this is really bad. And people have not even just been asleep at the wheel. People have been selling us a line. They've been selling us a story so that we don't fight back. We don't say, wait a minute, this is not sustainable, right? We are just literally extracting from our planet more carbon, more of everything, using it up, deforesting, right? Cutting down the trees, using the land, using the resources, just more. We're using too much of it. So what do we do? There are so many solutions. And that's part of the thing. So the challenge to all the students who are listening, to all the faculty who are listening, the first thing is to stare at the reality in the face. And the second thing is to say, actually, there are solutions. So what is it that's stopping us from those solutions. Like, let's study that. Let's think about that. Why can we not just find these solutions? We need to stop our addiction to fossil fuels. Boom, that's it. We have to get off fossil fuels. We're gonna have to really think about, where do we need growth? Who needs more? Do we need more? Probably not. Are there people in the world who do need more? Yes. Are there people who could probably do with having a little less? I would say definitely yes, right? How do we make those decisions? How do we start that conversation? How do we think about smart growth instead of like endless growth? How do we think about sustainable growth? So how do we start to have those conversations? And then how do we start thinking, you know, pretty much everybody who lives in LA, for example, is not super fond of our public transportation system. We don't really love the fact that we don't have any parks. We hate traffic. Well, you know what? We could like demand better. What if we thought about a world where we could demand better, where we could say, yeah, it would be better if we didn't have people who don't have any homes all over? What if we felt safe in the city? What if we had parks? What if we had green spaces, right? Like, those things start opening up. What if we had a different kind of policing? On and on. So look at the problem in the face, demand that the people who are teaching you tell the truth, demand your institution tell the truth, demand your politicians tell the truth. And then this is the really radical act, start to imagine a better future, because we can have it. The end.
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage to have hope in a world like this, I think.
I would add the rebellious
thing you can do is be hopeful.
Yeah. And you can't be hopeful by yourself.
No.
Right. There is really no, like, that's kind of just like, you know, being in a dreamland, right? So I think that's kind of part of what the whole teach-in idea and the activist idea, right, is that if we're gonna, you know, the steps that we have to take in the form of communities and in the form of being together. And so I think that's like what we're hoping that History Rebellion brings people to, you know. It's like, we don't want to just be two people going on a podcast talking to a handful of other people, but the idea is like, hopefully we can form some kind of mass, some kind of community, and then make action from there. And then I think, you know, it starts to feel like it has meaning, right? You recycle a plastic bottle yourself, and it's kind of silly, and it's kind of, you know, can even feel like you're just being part of a greenwashing game, right? But if everybody can get together and demand that, you know, a bunch of different kinds of plastic don't get manufactured anymore, well, that's going to actually change crap. But it's hard to do that by yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Zeroing in on what's really going to make the change. But yeah, on, I guess, to finish it out on a happy note, keep being hopeful and find that inspiration. For me, being in environmental studies, like, my fellow students in my program make me hopeful every day for, you know, the future leaders that are hopefully going to be helping to tackle these issues. And even, you know, students outside my program too. There's so much cool innovation and ideas. And, you know, Bo is an economics major and he's part of this podcast and clearly has a passion for sustainability, and you're both history professors. So there's absolutely a space for everyone, and it's needed. So find your space and do it. Just, yeah, not very eloquent, but hopefully everyone gets the gist. Okay, that'll wrap up our episode for today. For more information on EcoAlarm and resources on topics covered in this episode, follow us at EcoAlarm Podcast on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Thank you guys so much for listening. Tune in every other Friday, and we'll see you next time. Bye.